One of us finds a partner and the other doesn't. How can we keep from feeling jealous and left out? Ah, maybe we can date together. If we present ourselves as a package deal, nobody will be able to come between us. We need a bisexual woman, of course, so she can have sex with both of us. And the thought of another man in the mix is uncomfortable anyway. That woman can be with us both, so she won't come between us or make one of us feel left out. And we'll make it an exclusive triad. She'll be just with us, so we won't feel threatened by her other partners. That way, we will both feel safe and comfortable. Couples looking for this setup are so common that they're a cliché among poly people. Very, very few such couples ever find such an imagined third person. Franklin knows one couple who have been searching for that bisexual woman for more than 40 years, without success. These couples often join organized poly groups but become frustrated and upset that their requirements are rebuffed. Many poly women do identify as bisexual, and more than a few are open to a man and a woman as partners, but experienced people almost always say no whenever a hopeful couple approaches. The couple usually offers an unequal balance of power, even when they believe they're offering equality. After all, they're the ones setting the terms of the relationship. A term for this is couple privilege. So if you're the couple, and those are your thoughts, know that you've chosen a difficult row to hoe, and you will be most likely never able to find such a person. Indeed, women willing to sign on to such a relationship are often called unicorns, because they're about as thin on the ground as mythical horned horses. As reasonable as this idea sounds from your perspective, it is very unreasonable from her perspective. If you were her, think about what the offer would look like. First, the couple says they want you to date both of them. Almost always, you will be expected to have sex with both of them. And you may also be told you can't have sex with one without the other there, because that might breed jealousy or resentment. And you will be expected to love them both equally. From the start, you're put in a position where you have little voice. Your relationships have already been scripted. Alas, the human heart rarely follows scripts. It is rare for someone to be attracted to two other people in the same way, at the same rate, at the same time. In fact, we've never seen it happen. So you're likely to be more attracted to and more connected with one member of the couple than the other, and that's likely to create tension. For many couples, if you express more attraction for one person than the other, you'll be kicked out immediately. Not everyone who's poly is an exhibitionist or likes group sex. Asking someone to have sex only in a group and only with two people is likely to come across as controlling, even to someone who does like group sex. All healthy relationships need some one-on-one time. But let's say you agree and start dating them both. And somewhere down the road, some sort of problem or incompatibility arises with one of them. What happens next? The relationship becomes coercive. You'll probably be told, "You knew we were a package deal. If you stop having sex with one of us or stop wanting a relationship with one of us, we will both break up with you." That puts you in the unenviable position of being told your only choices are, one, to continue having sex with or being romantically vulnerable to someone you don't feel close to, or, two, to have your heart broken. As for the polyfidelity requirement, most of us come to polyamory because we reject the idea that being in a relationship means being forbidden to be with anyone else. Yet, that's what's being offered in this arrangement. People who identify as polyamorous generally won't be excited about entering a restrictive relationship. Franklin has known several people who have dated both members of a couple under these circumstances. Without exception, they were badly hurt and say they would never do it again. We're not saying polyfidelitous triads don't exist. All the ones we've seen, however, have formed when a member of a couple starts dating a new partner, and then, sometime later, that new partner develops an attraction for the other member of the couple. They formed organically, rather than being scripted. The truth is, structure can never solve the problem of jealousy, as we talk about in Chapter 8. Going to a polyfidelitous relationship can seem like a way to ease in to polyamory. But it's a bit like trying to ease into skydiving by saying, "I don't want to just jump out of the plane. That's too scary. so I'll climb out carefully, maybe sit on the wing for a while, to get a feel for what it's like, and get comfortable trusting my parachute. Not only will this not work, it will put you and your fellow skydivers in jeopardy. If you don't trust your parachute, skydiving probably isn't for you. By trust your parachute, we mean building the tools of communication and jealousy management, trusting your partner, and believing that she wants to take care of you even if other partners are involved in the mix, before you open up. Couplehood and identity. One of the problems that can arise in opening from a couple to polyamory is the competing expectations of monogamous culture and polyculture. Marriages are often portrayed as combining two lives into one. Society expects that couples do almost everything together. A spouse is often called my other half. In extreme cases, this tips into codependence. Each person becomes so dependent on the other that they're unable to express their needs as individuals or make decisions alone. Yet, when you're looking for a partner, very often it's who you are as an individual that makes you attractive. Couples who think of themselves as a unit aren't likely to be seen as attractive prospects, because it can seem as if there's no room for anyone else. If the two people think of themselves as one, where's the room to have and express individual distinct relationships with each of them? Is a new relationship going to involve each member of the couple as an individual, or will it be required to address the couple as one entity? If the latter, what happens if a conflict arises within the couple, or between you and one member? Yet attempts to assert individuality can feel very threatening, especially to couples who have been together a long time. As scary as it may be, asserting your individuality doesn't mean damaging your existing relationship. You were individuals when you met, and that worked out, didn't it? You can still be individuals while you maintain close, intimate bonds with your partner. Presenting yourself as a whole person who is closely connected with another can become closely connected with new people too, rather than as half of a unit, makes finding new partners and developing new relationships much easier, and it helps prevent codependence. When not to open up? There's never a perfect time to start a new relationship. Life is messy and complicated. It's rare that the merry-go-round of our day-to-day lives stops long enough to let someone on board without a fuss. That said, sometimes are less opportune than others. Those times might include when your current relationship is unhealthy or when you have young children. There's a snarky saying amongst polyfolk, often delivered with an eye roll. Relationship broken, add more people. This expression is used to refer to people, often but not always, in monogamous couplehood, who seek new partners to try and fix issues in their own relationship. Perhaps they're feeling bored or stifled. Maybe the sexual spark is gone. Perhaps they're having difficulty talking about their needs. Regardless, the solution, or so it seems, is to open up to new, exciting relationships in hopes of turbocharging what's already there or fixing the broken bits. Polyamory won't fix a broken relationship. We're not saying a relationship needs to be perfect before you open it to polyamory, but polyamory will put pressure on any weakness that exists. It is not a solution to relationship problems. Polyamory may make it easy for one person to escape an issue temporarily by retreating into the new shiny, but the issue will always come back, often worse than before. And once you have more partners, there are more people to hurt. There may be certain narrow exceptions. For example, we've known people with specific sexual kinks, not shared by their partner, who've started relationship with others who share those kinks. And if, as with Eve and Peter, monogamy itself is the problem with your relationship, if you are compatible partners but are chafing at trying to squeeze yourself into a monogamous mold, then polyamory might help. Generally speaking, though, polyamory will work best when any and all of your existing relationships are in good shape. People are not duct tape, something to wrap around your leaky pipes of your current relationship until you can get a plumber in to fix the problem for real. From swinging to poly. Some folks who hear about polyamory confuse it with swinging, though it isn't really the same thing, at least not the lurid Hollywood stereotype of swinging, where people throw lavish parties, drink champagne and have sex with all and sundry. Mind you, that's not the way most people who practice swinging go about it either. Much swinging is a private affair, where a small group of people, often close friends, will get together and have sex. Long-term personal friendships can and do develop out of this kind of swinging. An overlap does exist between swingers and polyamorous people, and many people come to poly from the much larger world of swinging. After all, sex and intimacy are closely linked, and many times the person in a swinging relationship has found himself getting attached to his partners. Sometimes things go the other way too. A person may be polyamorous and also enjoy casual sex. The difference between swinging and polyamory is largely a matter of whether sex or relationships are the prime focus. But some of the difference is simply in the different cultures that have been developed around each. Franklin has been peripherally involved in several swingers groups in several cities. Many, though not all swingers, he's spoken to self-identify as monogamous. Often swingers are married couples who consider themselves emotionally fiddlicious, but sexually non-fiddlicious. Quite a few swingers operate under the premise that they are free to explore sex outside their relationship, at least in controlled settings such as parties, but love and emotional intimacy are not permitted. This doesn't describe all swingers, of course, but it is a common theme among many swingers. We've met swingers who have operated under these conditions for years, and then, wham! They wake up one day to discover someone has fallen in love, and they have no idea what happens next. If you arrive at polyamory from swinging, you'll likely find the transition a lot easier if your swinging didn't include the assumption of emotional fidelity. If it did start from that assumption, welcome. You'll probably find a lot in common with people in mono-poly relationships. Relationships where one person is polyamorous and the other monogamous. Some of the challenges will likely be easier. You've likely already resolved at least some of the sexual jealousy that people in a mono-poly relationship may face. Though many swingers deal with this jealousy by only having sex with others while they're together, and this may not be sustainable in a polyamorous relationship. Other challenges, like mourning and letting go of the desire for emotional monogamy, will probably be similar. And the same strategies apply to dealing with them. And again, we highly recommend finding a poly discussion group where you can talk to other people who have already walked your path. Polyamory after cheating. Franklin has received dozens of emails from people looking for a path to polyamory after an episode of cheating. Often a person will cheat, and then after confessing or being caught, will want to start a polyamorous relationship with the person he was cheating with. Some poly folks have a history of cheating in monogamous relationships, often because monogamy felt stifling, but they didn't know that non-monogamy was possible. When they find out about poly, they set out to build poly relationships. Other people cheat on a partner, then try to transition that relationship to poly. We've talked to people who have made this journey from cheating to polyamory. It is possible, but it's a long and rough road, and the success rate is not high. Moving from failed monogamous relationships into starting new relationships openly on a polyamorous footing is much easier than trying to rebuild a relationship damaged by cheating. That's because cheating represents a profound betrayal of trust. It's the trust, more than the sex, that creates a hard path to polyamory. The cornerstones of ethical polyamory, as we've discussed, are consent and communication. Cheating undermines both. And it's nearly impossible to rebuild a relationship until trust and communication are restored. There are many reasons why a person might cheat. Some people like the thrill of the forbidden, or the rush that comes with doing something they might be caught at. Some people cheat because they want to experience something new, but don't know how to ask for it, or they believe it is not available to them. Some people want to experience multiple sex partners, but don't want their partner to do the same thing, which, as you can imagine, is especially problematic from a polyamorous perspective. Others just fall in love but don't want to lose their partners or families, and they don't know that any other option exists. The reason a person chooses to cheat are important when looking for a path from cheating to honest non-monogamy, and yes, it is a choice. Many folks who are caught cheating say it was an accident, as though they slipped on an icy sidewalk and fell into someone's bed. Cheating might not be planned, but unplanned is not the same thing as accidental. Calling cheating an accident is a way of avoiding responsibility for making the decision. Finding the path to polyamory starts with acknowledging the affair and, just as importantly, acknowledging that it was a choice, not an accident. It also requires assuming responsibility for the cheating. All too often, cheaters shift the blame. If my partner were thus and such, then I wouldn't have needed to cheat. The thus and such might be more sexually available or more adventurous or less reluctant to do what I want. In reality, the affair is a choice made by the cheating partner, and that's where the responsibility lies. Rebuilding trust is hard. In fact, it's so hard after cheating that we advise talking to an experienced, poly-friendly counselor or therapist. We talk in Chapter 25 about finding one. Professional help will almost certainly be an important part of building the trust necessary for an ethical polyamorous relationship. That trust will never be rebuilt unless you are willing to tell the truth about everything. Come 100% clean. No evasions, no holding back. The path from cheating to poly isn't easy, and an absolute commitment to honesty is the only thing that makes it possible. Honest, open transparency is a learned skill, and mastering it takes time and effort. A relationship might have all sorts of patterns that make honesty hard. Again, this is something a qualified counselor or therapist can help with. In this case, it's also important to think about whether polyamory is really what you want. Many of the people Franklin has spoken to who try to move from cheating to polyamory originally started their affairs because having an affair seemed less scary than talking openly with their partners. As often as not, the scary part about open non-monogamy was the idea that their partner might also want another lover. In other words, they cheated because they wanted to have additional lovers but didn't want their partner to. Sometimes, when caught in this situation, people are tempted to say, "We can start a polyfidelitous relationship with the person I was cheating with." This can feel like a solution that lets the cheater going on having the affair, sometimes with a side helping of watching his spouse and his illicit partner getting it on with each other, but without fear of having his new spouse explore other relationships. As you can guess, we view this fantasy very skeptically. For starters, a person who has already shown a willingness to cheat in a monogamous relationship may well cheat in a polyfidelitous relationship. The same factors that led to the affair may still be present. Moreover, it's difficult to sympathize with the notion that we'll be polyfidelicious so I can keep my illicit partner, but you can't have one. Finding the path from cheating to polyamory requires the active buy-in of everyone, and building fairness means not starting from the assumption that the cheated upon person will never have other partners in the future, even if they can't imagine wanting them now. If you're trying to move from cheating to polyamory, be prepared to question everything about your relationship. It's also reasonable for the cheated upon person to need time. Expecting someone who's just been cheated on to embrace polyamory immediately after learning of the infidelity is excessively optimistic. For the functional poly relationship to arise overnight from the ashes of an affair is highly unlikely. Even when a relationship does move from cheating to polyamory, you don't always get to keep your illicit lover. Often, the illicit lover won't be okay with this. Even if he is, the cheated upon person may never be okay with someone who's already shown a reckless disregard for his needs and boundaries. And when we say finding the path requires the active participation of everyone involved, that includes the third person. For the relationship to transition to polyamory with the same cast of characters, that person is going to need to feel included, empowered, and welcomed. Yes, welcomed. Like we said, this isn't easy. In most situations, couples counselors recommend that a person caught in an affair cut off all contact with the third person. Obviously, if the goal is to create a working polyamorous relationship, that's not going to be good advice. But you can't have it both ways. Relationships tend to work when everyone feels empowered. A polyamorous relationship isn't likely to succeed if the third person is simultaneously treated like a partner and resented outsider. As uncomfortable as it may be, including that person in counseling might be a good idea. During this transition, it might help for each person to consider what they want the new relationship to look like and then negotiate for that. After infidelity, you're essentially creating an entirely new relationship. Being willing to start from first principles and build something that reflects the needs of everyone involved is going to be necessary. Of course, not all cheating is the same. Different people have different ideas of where the cheating line is. To some, cybersex chat with strangers is cheating. To others, it's their spouse's harmless fun. The point is, there are levels of cheating and differences of opinion about it. Generally speaking, if you're doing something you can't tell your partner about, you're probably cheating. Because there are graduations of cheating, some violations are easier to recover from than others. If your relationship prohibits kissing someone else, it will probably be easier to recover from a kiss than from someone getting pregnant. In any case, talking to your partner and coming clean will almost certainly be easier if you do it sooner rather than later. Put another way, if you steal first base, talk to your partner before you hit a home run. Questions to ask yourself. If you're thinking about transitioning from a monogamous relationship into polyamory, you're not alone, but you're in for some pretty big changes. The things you probably think are important likely won't be, and the things you haven't thought about might matter most. Here are some questions that may be helpful. What assumptions do I have about what my relationships should look like? How are these assumptions influenced by the cultural narratives about monogamy, and how much are they truly mine? What parts of my relationships are most important? How can I preserve those elements while knowing that my relationship will change over time? What guarantees do I want from my relationships? Are they realistic? How much space do I have to devote to new relationships right now? As I seek new relationships, what guarantees can I offer my new partner that I will make space for them, listen to their needs, and be able to change to accommodate these new relationships? Where does my sense of security come from in my relationships? What am I willing to do to help my partner feel secure? And will those things come at a cost to any new relationships I may start? 18. Mono, poly relationships. Surely the most ubiquitous misunderstanding of love is love hurts. Loving never hurts. It's wanting others to be different from how they are and not getting what you want that we find so painful. Christopher Wallace. A fish and a bird can fall in love, so the saying goes, and so can a monogamist and a polyamorist. It happens a lot, actually. This isn't surprising, given how outnumbered poly people are by mono people. But it sure puts the fairy tale idea that true love conquers all to the test. Spoiler alert, it doesn't. What can you do? Is your relationship doomed? Can such a pairing ever work? The good news is that the mono-poly relationship is common enough that it's become something of a poly archetype. So there are plenty of people willing to share their experiences. A good mono-poly relationship is possible. We have both seen examples of successful, happy relationship between a monogamous and a polyamorous person. But getting there is hard. In fact, it is among the most difficult poly structures to navigate in a way that promotes and respects the happiness of everyone involved. These relationships require patience, persistence, and compassion. They require careful communication and a willingness to do some deep soul searching. The people must be willing to work together, and the poly person's other partners also need to be willing to show sensitivity and kindness to the needs of the monogamous person. Defining monogamy. The concept of monogamy is more complicated than it seems. When someone calls herself monogamous, talk about what the expectations she has. Some people consider themselves monogamous because they want only one partner, but it's okay if the partner has other lovers. Others identify as monogamous because they want a relationship in which their one partner is also exclusively faithful to them. The concept gets more complicated because different people have different ideas about what constitutes fidelity. Some swingers self-identify as monogamous. For them, sex without emotional attachment doesn't count. Other people consider even a platonic relationship, perhaps online where the people never meet, to be a profound betrayal. As you might imagine, a poly relationship with a monogamous partner who says, "I only want her, but it's okay if she has other relationships," is a lot easier than a poly relationship with someone who says, I want it to be only you and me. Mono-poly relationships also follow a different course when the monogamous person falls in love with a poly person who already has other partners than when the couple start a relationship together and the door to polyamory opens later. The two of us have extensive experience with mono-poly relationships of both varieties. For 18 years, Franklin was in a mono-poly relationship with his ex-wife Celeste, who strongly preferred a relationship involving only two people. And for 3 of those years, he had a second partner who was this variety of monogamous as well. Today, he has a partner whose husband self-identifies as monogamous, but is okay with his wife having multiple relationships. Eve's ex-partner, Ray, was married to a monogamous woman. Both of us have close friends in mono-poly pairings. We have learned a lot of lessons from these experiences. You won't change each other. Poly folks have heard this story a million times. George and Iris have been together a couple of years. He's poly, she's mono. In fact, Iris says the very thought of polyamory exhausts her. But George believes she will someday wake up to its advantages. Iris believes that George will eventually settle down to monogamy. George has even said he would marry Iris if it didn't mean pledging a lifetime of exclusivity to her. They're in love, and each is prepared to patiently wait for the other to change. We have a word in the poly world for monogamous people like Iris, who knowingly pair up with a poly person hoping to change them. Cowgirls, or cowboys. They ride up alongside a poly crowd to rope one out of the herd. There's no special nickname for the poly person who hopes to change his mono partner, but there should be. Both are setting themselves up for long-term pain and thwarted dreams. The cowgirl-cowboy story usually goes like this. The monogamous person has internalized the narrative of monogamous culture, that polyamory is just a phase, that when he meets the one, who is, of course, herself, he will settle down. The poly person, meanwhile, believes the mono person will come around once she feels secure, or starts to want variety, or sees other poly relationships working, or just sees the light. Each says they accept the other's nature. The monogamous person may even agree to an open relationship in theory. Just not yet. Not until the relationship is stable and feels secure. And the poly person gives her that time. And more time. And whenever they talk about opening the relationship, there's some reason not to. Maybe there's some external stressor, or there's something wrong with the person the poly partner wants to date. And after a lot of time has passed, the two are deeply bonded, and the poly person seriously falls for someone new. Well, of course, that person is seen as a threat, because the poly person wants to change the now long-established default. The problem is that both parties entered and continued the relationship on the assumption that they would eventually change the other. Yet for many people, polyamory and monogamy aren't things they simply change. They are fundamental. Mistress Matisse put it well in her column on cowboys and cowgirls when she said, "Dismissing people's stated definitions of their sexuality as something you can make them change is not love." Mono-poly relationships only work when each person wholeheartedly embraces who the other is, allowing them to live the way that's most authentic for them, without judgment. Solid, intimate relationships do not come from a place of wishing our loved ones would be someone else. Intimacy comes from accepting and loving others for who they are. The cost of mono-poly relationships. That's all well and good when both start the relationship understanding who the other is. It's harder when they both planned on a monogamous relationship, and then one of them realizes his or her true poly nature or beliefs. In this case, giving up monogamy is a scarier step. The monogamous person may feel deep loss. The relationship doesn't look the way he wants, or the way the other relationships look. It can feel like the polyamorous person is always getting what she wants, other lovers, other intimate companions. The monogamous person can feel like he's losing time, attention, and focus, and sometimes this may be absolutely true. From the poly person's point of view, a mono-poly relationship can feel constricting. The poly person may feel that she is not permitted to follow her heart. She may feel controlled. She may feel that her partner doesn't really understand or accept her, and that she is being forced to live out a dream deferred. We don't want to paint a picture that's entirely doom and gloom. As we said, we both know people in happy, successful, mono-poly relationships. At the same time, we don't want to whitewash the challenges you may face if you choose this kind of relationship. Challenges for the monogamous partner. A monogamous person embarking on a poly relationship will probably spend some time mourning the loss of the relationship she expected and coming to terms with polyamory. This is a process. The polyamorous partner needs to treat the process with respect and compassion. A monogamous partner may see polyamory as a problem to be managed, rather than a source of joy for a loved one. She may find it difficult to recognize that polyamory isn't a flaw or a failing. It's a different way of seeing relationships, and a positive one at that. Many monogamous people we've met try to establish security by limiting what their poly partners do. That's a dangerous road, as we've said, in part because the people who usually suffer the most are the polyamorous person's other partners. Monogamous social structures don't equip us to treat a lover's other lovers compassionately. Yet learning to extend compassion to a partner's other lovers is a vital skill in mono-poly relationships. When a poly person is allowed to invite people into her heart, but not too far, it often creates a situation where everyone is unhappy. And the people who suffer the most also have the least power to ask for things to help end their suffering. This is especially true if those other partners are also poly and want a relationship that includes being part of the family. Here is Franklin's story.
When I first started my relationship with Bella, it wasn't the sex that Celeste felt most threatened by. It was the things that normally signify family, like love, cohabitation, and planning for the future. Bella wanted the freedom to love and be loved by me, to participate in my day-to-day life, and even, if the time came, to be able to live with me. Celeste wanted, above everything else, to be the sole person to fill that role in my life. In my desire to make Celeste feel comfortable and secure, I made it clear to Bella those options were permanently off the table, which caused great pain for both of us and undermined our relationship. Bella felt, rightly, that I had invited her in without allowing her in or giving her a way to ask for what she needed.
Challenges for the polyamorous partner. In a mono-poly relationship, the poly person may see her monogamous partner's needs as obstacles to be worked around, or as unreasonable expectations to be dealt with. She may feel that if the monogamous person would just get with the program, these needs would fall by the wayside. The poly person must recognize that monogamy is not an imposition. It's a valid, healthy, and reasonable way to conduct romantic relationships. The monogamous partner isn't unevolved, unenlightened, or selfish. There is nothing wrong with wanting one exclusive partner. Compassion for the feelings and expectations of the monogamous partner is essential. If you are the poly partner of a monogamous person, you have some work to do. What compromises can you make while still conducting your other relationships with integrity? How can you set boundaries that create a safe space for your monogamous partner, but not at the expense of your other partners? This balancing act requires flexibility, adaptability, self-knowledge, and compassion. Assumptions and social expectations. We all carry a pile of social assumptions, which may or may not be true, into our relationships. In poly relationships, some of our standard expectations certainly won't be true. Expectations are often invisible unless we specifically look for them. In mono-poly relationships, these expectations can be landmines ready to blow up at any step. Communication is especially vital in mono-poly relationships because when we don't talk openly about something, the default social norms tend to dominate. Some of the assumptions Franklin has experienced firsthand from his monogamous partners include ideas like, "If you truly love me, I should be enough for you." And, "If I'm not enough for you, something is wrong with me." This would come up most often in the earlier stages of a new connection. Often Celeste would respond to a new flirtation by asking, "Why aren't the partners you have enough?" Or, "What's missing from your life that you need to go out and look for something more?" These are difficult questions to answer because to a poly person, they come from assumptions that don't make sense. Answers such as, "It isn't about being enough. Even if I were with partners who were perfect in every way, I'd still be open to new connections. Or, nothing is missing from my life. Relationships aren't about filling in missing spaces. These were never very satisfying to Celeste. One of the most difficult hurdles to overcome can be the assumption that a person is polyamorous because something is missing. Sometimes polyamory does offer an opportunity to satisfy an unmet need. We've both met poly people who are interested in BDSM, but have a partner who isn't, or have an asexual partner. But even in those situations, polyamory isn't a reflection on the deficiencies of the monogamous person. It's just a recognition of a difference. Polyamory can even be a benefit to the monogamous partner. We've both met people who feel guilty over not being able to provide their partners with something. A friend of Franklin's, for instance, is not interested in bondage, but has a female partner who absolutely loves it. When she started dating a new partner who was also enthusiastic about bondage, he felt intimidated at first. Would she leave him? After time went by and that didn't happen, he no longer felt guilty about not being able to provide her with what she wanted. This idea seems easier to grasp for old relationships than for new ones. When Franklin was married to Celeste, he started a relationship with Elaine, who also self-identified as monogamous. She did not feel threatened by Franklin's two existing partners, because they predated his relationship with her. It seemed obvious that their existence wasn't a reflection on her worth. However, a year later, when someone else expressed an interest in Franklin, Elaine became very upset and asked, "Why am I not enough? What am I lacking that makes you start dating someone else?" When a monogamous person begins dating a polyamorous person, existing relationships are part of the landscape. Simply being comfortable with existing relationships is not necessarily a good indicator of how much success a monogamous person will have in a mono-poly relationship. Be ready to talk about that. From the perspective of a monogamous person, polyamory may look like a license to behave indiscriminately. It can be difficult to shake the notion that commitment and exclusivity are the same thing. This can lead to thoughts that a polyamorous person can't or won't commit, and therefore must be unreliable or wildly promiscuous. Nor is polyamory, necessarily, about a need for sexual variety. Franklin once had a discussion with a monogamous person who asked, "If my partner is polyamorous, can't he be satisfied if we role-play different characters in bed?" Polyamory might look like a need for sexual variety, but a better way to think about it is in terms of openness to a deep personal connection. Not too different from the way most people are open to making new friends. Social recognition is also a big issue in the mono-poly relationships we've seen and been a part of. A monogamous person in a poly relationship often wants the social recognition that comes with being conventionally partnered, and often feels uncomfortable with public signs of partnership that involve others. Celeste was not comfortable with Franklin holding hands with anyone else in public, and she did not want her social circle to know that Franklin had other partners. She also felt threatened when Franklin's partner Bella wanted to have portraits taken with him. The social recognition as Franklin's partner was important to her and wasn't something she wanted to share. You might question Franklin's wisdom in starting two simultaneous mono-poly relationships. You'd probably be right. Myla's story. In Myla's perfect world, she would have had a monogamous relationship with her partner, Morgan. When she fell in love with him, she knew he was poly and that he was already in a relationship with Nina. Intellectually, polyamory made sense to her, but the emotional reality was different. Coming to terms with and even finding joy in her mono-poly relationship with Morgan was not an easy road. One of the things Myla consistently found triggering were public expressions of Morgan and Nina's relationship. She was deeply hurt when Nina had family photos taken with Morgan and posted them on Facebook. She struggled with the swinging relationship they had with another couple. It wasn't the sex that bothered her, but the fact that Morgan and Nina participated as a couple. And she panicked when Morgan made arrangements for Nina to meet his parents over the same holiday week, coincidentally, when Myla was to meet them. Myla was tempted to restrict Morgan's relationship with Nina, particularly displays of public coupledom. But she chose instead to work through the roots of the feelings. In some cases, she negotiated temporary boundaries with Morgan and Nina, such as restraining public displays of affection when the three of them were at dinner with friends, while she worked through her feelings. Her biggest fear, she discovered, was being perceived as a victim or having people feel sorry for her. In the case of meeting Morgan's parents, she found it helped her to be present at the meeting and to plan with Morgan and Nina beforehand how they would all present a united front. In doing so, she demonstrated to Morgan's parents that she was fully consenting to the situation and had agency in her relationship with Morgan. Placing restrictions on public affection with other partners usually doesn't work. In our experience, it creates resentment. There can be a sense of being forced into fakery. Sometimes it is just an issue that people need time and space to work through. Sometimes it can be dealt with by inclusion. Franklin and Celeste dealt with Celeste's discomfort around having portraits taken by going together as a group and having portraits taken that showed Franklin and Celeste, that showed Franklin and Bella, and showed all three. The portrait photographer handled this with grace. Myla's story. During the early months of Myla's relationship with Morgan, sharing him was hard. She had never felt insecure or jealous before. There were lots of tears and emotional outbursts. Myla struggled to set boundaries, to find her bottom line in her relationship with Morgan. Morgan worked hard with Myla to establish trust. Without his integrity and patience, she's not sure she would have made it through. He said the hard things to her when they needed to be said, and never wavered in them, even when it would have been easier not to say them, to let her pretend their relationship was something other than it was. He created a safe space for her and gave her time to process her feelings. He didn't try to get involved when she was upset or put words in her mouth. He let her be an emotional wreck and reassured her that her feelings were okay. She says, "I was allowed to have a hard time, to be insecure. I didn't feel rushed to figure it all out." Ultimately, Morgan's integrity and communication skills were an important part of her motivation to see the relationship through. Cultivating trust. By now, you've probably noticed that a theme in this book is trust. We believe that trust between partners is an essential part of happy, stable relationships. A surprisingly large number of poly problems are actually about trust. Trusting in your partner's enthusiastic willingness to take care of you, and your partner demonstrating that this trust is well placed, solves many problems in poly relationships. But this can be tricky in mono-poly relationships, because it's hard to trust someone whose motivations you don't fully understand. When someone's motivations don't make sense to you, you will find it difficult to predict what choices they will make. Here is Franklin's story.
During the time I was with both Celeste and Elaine, I attended a week-long computer convention out of town. While I was there, Celeste and Elaine spent a great deal of time talking to each other, and somehow convinced each other that I was engaging in all sorts of random, no-string sex with the beautiful women they imagined I was meeting at the convention. The reality was far more mundane. I spent all day at workshops on computer programming and network administration, and most nights in the hotel room watching reruns of Law and Order. I did not have even a single sexual encounter, much less the dozens they imagined to be filling my nights. There was no reason to believe I would be looking for flings. I've never had a taste for casual sex. But because they both struggled to understand why I wasn't satisfied with conventional romantic relationships, they believed they couldn't predict how I might behave, so they ended up imagining far-fetched fantasies.
When two people don't say eye to eye, it's easy for a tiny seed of doubt to blossom into a full-blown breakdown of trust. Mono-poly relationships require special commitment to trust and communication. Being willing to take a leap of faith that your partner is dedicated to your relationship, even if you don't understand your partner's motivations, becomes especially important. On the other side, as the poly person, when opportunities to build trust arise, you really have to behave with integrity. If you've made promises to your monogamous partner, keep them. Even if you don't understand why he wants them. If they create real problems, don't break them. Renegotiate them. Cultivate trust by demonstrating that you are worthy of trust. Finally, for the monogamous person, trust in yourself and in your self-efficacy. It is as important as trust in your partner. Myla found that sticking with it and getting through those early struggles gave her confidence that she could get through future struggles. She was terrified at the beginning of her relationship with Morgan when polyamory was a complete unknown. Now she trusts that if hard times come, she can get through them and be okay. Strategies for the monogamous partner. Being happy in a mono-poly relationship means finding a way to make the relationship work for you. For example, if you know there's something you can't offer a partner, It might take stress off you when your partner finds someone else who can. If you're introverted and your partner is extroverted, polyamory might let you spend time doing things you want while your partner is socializing with another lover. If you see polyamory as a problem to be worked around, you're less likely to be happy than if you find a way to make it a benefit for you too. That doesn't necessarily mean you have to have multiple relationships yourself. It might mean polyamory gives you the opportunity to explore other interests or hobbies. We talk more about this in the strategy sections later in this chapter. Your partner is poly because he is poly. There's nothing wrong with you. No matter who you are, no matter what you could be or do, he would still be poly. If you have a child and you decide to add another, it probably isn't because something is wrong with the first child. It's about bringing more love and intimacy into your life. Polyamory is the same. You don't have to make peace with this all at once. It's okay to need time. Polyamory is a radical change, and sometimes it takes a while to process change. There will be times when you feel jealous or insecure. That's okay. It doesn't mean you're doing something wrong. It's also okay to ask your partner for help when this happens. Not help as in, I don't want you to ever have other partners, but help as in, I need your reassurance and support here. There's nothing wrong in asking your partner to take time to show you why you're valued. There's nothing wrong with being monogamous. If you don't want other lovers, don't try to force yourself to have other lovers. If you want to explore what it's like, that's one thing, but you don't have to in order to be with a polyamorous person. There's nothing wrong with being who you are, and there's nothing wrong with your partner for being poly. It isn't a moral failing. It isn't because poly people can't commit. That's important to keep in mind. Suggesting that polyamory is a problem or that there's something wrong with your partner is unlikely to make your relationship better. Your partner's other partners are human beings. It can be hard at times not to resent them. It can be tempting to tell yourself they have no right to be there. That's not true. Polyamory is a valid relationship model, and the people involved in a poly relationship have a right to be there, just as you do. Your partner's other partners are not your enemy. They don't necessarily have to be your family or even your friends, but respecting them and treating them kindly as people your partner loves and who add value to your partner's life will definitely help the relationship run smoothly. As we like to emphasize, people are not interchangeable. It may seem that if your partner has another lover who's similar to you or likes the same things you do, then she doesn't need you anymore. But remember, she is non-monogamous and doesn't think that way. She loves you for who you are. Doing something with you is an entirely different experience from doing the same thing with someone else. And if your partner has a lover who's very different from you, it's not a covert way of saying that the different things about you aren't good, wonderful, or valuable, or that she wants you to be like someone else. Accept the reality that your partner has other partners. Attempting to hang on to the trappings of monogamy, for example, by maintaining a don't-ask-don't-tell relationship, is likely to create a lot more trouble than it solves. When we don't know what's happening, our fears run wild. We can start to think about all our partners' other partners as far smarter, more dazzling, more sophisticated, while we sit at home with the cat. This creates a potent environment for resentment to spread. Franklin calls denial the Miami approach to mono-poly relationships. Imagine that you really want to live in Miami. Sun-drenched beaches and swaying palm trees call out to you, but you find yourself living in New York instead. You're unlikely to succeed in adapting to New York life if you stubbornly insist you're in Miami. If you wear shorts in December and refuse to negotiate snow, you'll probably find your unhappiness is increasing. You'll be happier if you acknowledge that snow is going to be a part of your life and that New York actually has a lot going for it. Another strategy that some people try to create is a privileged relationship tier that places the needs of the monogamous person over the needs of anyone else. As we discuss in Chapter 11, this is apt to create problems as well. If you're accustomed to monogamy, every time your partner touches someone else affectionately, that can feel like a rejection of you. This can cause you to pull away from your partner, which makes the feeling even worse. These feelings are hard to address directly. Because when you're feeling rejected, the last thing you want to do is make yourself vulnerable by opening up to your partner about what you're feeling. The only way we've found to avoid a self-reinforcing cycle of rejection and defensiveness is to confront the feeling head-on. When your partner is affectionate with someone else, understand that it's not about you. Speak up and ask for support. strategies for the polyamorous partner. You're asking your partner to believe, in the face of overwhelming social messages to the contrary, that you're not looking to replace him, that the reason you're open to other partners is not because there's something wrong with him, that you're not asking for permission to cheat, and you don't have one foot out of the door. That's a lot to deal with. You're asking your partner to accept that having other lovers isn't just a way for you to move from one relationship to the next. Make sure that's true. Make sure you are worthy of that trust. We can't turn a lifetime of expectations around on a dime. Give your partner space and time. Allow your partner room to experience her emotions, to have freakouts, and to get through to the other side. Be compassionate. As we described above in the section on trust, a huge factor in Myla's relationship was Morgan's ability to give her time and space to process without blaming her or expecting too much too soon. Being polyamorous is not a license to do whatever you want. There will be times when your partner struggles and needs your support. Be there. Be supportive. Be willing to hold his hand when things are tough. Be willing to go the extra mile to talk about what you value in him, why you love your relationship with him, and why you want to be with him. Time management is important in any poly relationship, but especially in a mono-poly relationship. Your partner may not be accustomed to spending time alone. Be transparent about your plans and intentions. Communicate openly about your schedule. Work with your partner to apportion time in a way that works for both of you. Your partner may never want to explore other relationships, and that's okay. Avoid starting from the idea that your being poly is fair if your partner is allowed to have multiple relationships just like you. If your partner doesn't want them, the opportunity to have them isn't a benefit. Don't assume that your partner will suddenly become polyamorous as soon as he discovers how wonderful it is. Strategies for mono-poly relationships. Many strategies for successful mono-poly relationships are the same as for any poly relationships. Communication, flexibility, willingness to face discomfort, and all the other things we talk about in this book. In any poly partnership, some people might be off with a different lover while another person is home alone. This happens often. In a mono-poly relationship, it's likely to happen much more often. Because of this, the monogamous partner will benefit from developing a rich life separate from her partner. Hobbies, social activities, and other interests can be really helpful. Myla's story. In her early attempts to adjust to her mono-poly relationship with Morgan, Myla turned to her monogamous friends for support. The advice they gave her was unhelpful. They blamed Morgan, told Myla to disregard Morgan and Nina's feelings, told her to put her foot down and say no to the situation. She found herself in the awful position of having to defend Morgan while seeking support. A turning point for Myla came when she reached out to her local poly community. She found a small, monthly discussion group that met her needs for empathy and shared wisdom. She was able to get support and advice for her struggles from people who had experience in poly relationships, and who did not immediately blame all her problems with Morgan on polyamory. They helped her counter some of the internal scripts from monogamous culture that she still struggled with. They helped her support her sense that Morgan and his other partners had good intentions toward her and were trustworthy, despite everything she was being told by societal norms and well-meaning mono friends. The monogamous person needs to have people, preferably outside the relationship, with whom she can talk and process her emotions. But finding such support can be difficult. Ideally, such a confidant won't just point to polyamory and say, "See, here's the problem." Yet, a person whose relationship background is entirely monogamous might not have poly-friendly friends to confide in. We strongly recommend finding a poly discussion group in your area, if you can. An online search for polyamory in your area can help turn up many of these. Most discussion groups will have several members in mono-poly relationships, and having other such people to turn to can be an invaluable source of support. Recognize that there are times, especially early on, when your relationship is going to be uncomfortable. Happiness is not merely the absence of discomfort. It requires doing the work, facing down fears and insecurities, and being willing to talk about and confront unpleasant things. There's nothing wrong with discomfort. Challenging our comfort zone is how we grow, and succeeding in a mono-poly relationship requires growth. Transparency is important. The polyamorous partner may hesitate to tell the monogamous person about new interests for fear of hurting him. The monogamous person might not want to talk about fears or insecurities for fear of upsetting the polyamorous partner. Wrong and wrong. Relationships live or die on the quality of the communication in them. It's vital that both people talk openly, even when talking openly is difficult. As discussed in chapter 17, it might be tempting to think, okay, I can give this poly stuff a try, but if it doesn't work out, we can go back to monogamy. Approaching polyamory this way is dangerous. It's one thing to talk about reverting back to monogamy when no one else is involved yet. It's quite another to discard other loves to do it. Treating other partners as disposable is not ethical. It will also damage your relationship. Telling a partner, okay, I've changed my mind, get rid of this other person you love, will probably hurt both of you. A tempting idea, particularly for monogamous people in a poly relationship, is to seek a feeling of safety and comfort by being able to reject the polyamorous person's other partners if they seem too threatening. As we discussed in chapter 12, that idea often backfires. Finding your bottom line. Monopoly relationships require flexibility, negotiation, and willingness to compromise. They also require a good understanding of our personal boundaries and the things we can't compromise on. We talked about creeping concessions in chapter 10. Monopoly relationships are especially prone to these. When people have radically different ideas about what their ideal relationship should look like, they will be especially tempted to make compromises that, over time, bargain away more than they intended. When negotiating a monopoly relationship, ask yourself, what are the essential things I must have? At what point will my needs no longer be met? What are my values? What must I have in order to act with integrity? Don't compromise on those. If you negotiate away your integrity, ethics, or agency, you are no longer a full and equal participant in the relationship. You must also be aware of your partner's boundaries, and not ask or expect her to compromise past those points. Talk about what she needs to have a happy, functioning relationship, and where those needs overlap with yours. Be careful not to compromise on behalf of other people. Sometimes when we're trying to find a way out of an impasse, we may be tempted to make compromises that affect others, especially when those others are still hypothetical. It can be tempting to try and ease stress by bargaining away their agency in advance, such as by agreeing to limitations on their behavior. When we do this, we are using the agency of other people as bargaining chips. Instead, focus on practical things your partner does have control over. If you need more time with her, say, I need more time with you. Not, I don't want you spending so much time with other people. Be concrete about the things that are bothering you. Schedules, chores, responsibilities, time with the kids, fun time together, and negotiate for those things specifically. Your relationship is a choice. Overwhelmingly, the social message we're given about relationships is that falling in love means moving in together, getting married, settling down, starting a family. The relationship escalator narrative doesn't dwell much on the notion of choice. It can seem that once we fall in love, we're on that ride whether we want to be or not. It can be surprisingly easy to lose track of the fact that we do in reality have choices, even if they're difficult. Here is Franklin's story.
When I met Celeste, she knew I'd never been in a monogamous relationship. We didn't expect to become romantic partners, much less married. The relationship that developed between us took us both by surprise. Through our relationship, we both had the idea that falling in love meant there was a path we were supposed to follow, and we were committed to that path. Celeste would say things like, "I'm in love with you, which means I can never leave." Because of this, we both ended up feeling that neither one of us had ever fully agreed to the relationship. Celeste felt like she hadn't quite consented to polyamory, even though she was aware I was not monogamous, because as soon as we were in love, we would have to follow the path. I felt the same way. At this point, the word polyamory wasn't in circulation yet, and I had never met anyone who wanted the same things I did. I felt I was alone in wanting non-monogamy. So any relationship I was in would have this built-in difference in goals and desires, so I had to make it work with Celeste. If I didn't, I would just have to start the same thing over with someone else, have the same arguments, make the same compromises. Because neither of us believed we had a choice, we were both held hostage to our feelings. We didn't think leaving the relationship was possible, and we didn't have good tools to deal with the differences in what we wanted. As a result, Celeste felt that polyamory was being inflicted on her without her consent, and I felt she couldn't really understand me.
In a mono-poly relationship, it is especially important that the people involved feel they are agreeing to the relationship on purpose, because they see value in each other that makes the relationship a positive choice for them both. When we believe, in contrast, that we must keep the relationship at all costs, it becomes difficult to give consent. As Franklin's partner Amber says, when we enter into a romantic relationship, we make a choice. Over time, we build a life. This may involve legal and financial commitments and responsibilities, but there is a difference between life-building and intimacy. Consent is about intimacy, and in every moment of every day, we should feel that we have a choice in the intimacy we participate in. And remember that no matter how much you love each other, you are not obligated to be in a relationship with each other. You have a choice. If it doesn't work, if one of you is hurting too much, it's okay to let it go. The fairy tale is wrong. True love really doesn't conquer all the time. Questions to ask yourself. Mono-poly relationships offer some unique challenges and require careful negotiation if they are to succeed. Before embarking on a mono-poly relationship, here are a few things to consider. If you are the monogamous partner, why do I identify as monogamous? Is it because I only want one partner for myself, or because I want my partner to be only with me, or both? Do I enjoy time to myself or without my partner? Do I have hobbies I enjoy alone or with others, and a social life that does not rely on my partner? Am I prepared to face uncomfortable feelings such as jealousy, insecurity, and fear about my partner's loyalty, and to put in the work required to overcome them? If you are the poly partner, am I prepared to give my monogamous partner time and space to process his feelings about polyamory? Am I prepared to make concessions in my relationship to help the monogamous person work through his feelings? Are there limits on the concessions I will make, either in terms of what I will agree to or the time span of the agreement? For both partners, do I fully understand my partner's choice to be monogamous or polyamorous? And am I able to accept my partner for who she is? Can I build a relationship that respects the agency, not only of each of us, but of others who are involved as well?